Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. And today, listeners, we have a real treat for you. We are going to be speaking with Professor Walter Oschel. He is the Distinguished Professor of Biology, co-director of the Center of Climate and Sustainable Studies, and director of the Global Change Research Group, as well as the coordinator of the joint doctoral program in ecology between San Diego State University and the University of California, Davis. Dr. Oschel is internationally recognized as a climate change expert for his pioneering research on ecosystems and global change, including the impacts of climate change ranging from the permafrost in the Arctic to the forests of East County. Dr. Oschel, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Can you start off by telling our listeners, how did you get involved in climate science? What made you go into this field?
That's a great question. I actually did my PhD work in the deserts, in Palm Desert, on basic ecology, and then moved to Montreal, to McGill University, and worked in the subarctic in Quebec, and from there was asked to join the International Biological Program in Barrow, Alaska. So I started working by chance in the Arctic and worked at first on basic adaptation of plants to the environment, how the environment affected them, then became more interested in how plants work together with the environment as ecosystems and responded to the environment and fed back on the environment. And then in the late 70s, I realized that atmospheric CO2 was increasing, that we were looking for a long period of increasing atmospheric carbon dioxide that would have direct effects on ecosystems, and then this in turn would cause global warming, and that global warming would have impacts on ecosystems.
Now, your findings are quite respected. I see here that you have published over 250 research papers and that your research has been cited over 22,000 times. So, listeners, if you're looking to hear from a real climate scientist, we have one here today. So let's talk a little bit about some of your work studying the impacts of the permafrost in the Arctic and why that is significant as a CO2 source.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Arctic is extremely important for several reasons. One of the main reasons is that because of permafrost, it tends to be a water-saturated environment with very little oxygen, so that the breakdown of organic matter is very slow. And over thousands of years, large amounts of carbon have accumulated in the Arctic ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And actually, the amount of carbon in northern ecosystems in the soil, in the upper meter of soil, is equal to twice that already in the atmosphere.
Okay.
So the concern was, my concern when I started this work was, if that CO2 started coming out of the upper layers of the soil, it would be a major positive feedback or reinforcement on global warming.
Right. Positive in the sense that it's occurring, but really a negative for humanity in a sense.
Exactly. And then in addition, there are large methane emissions in the Arctic. And as it warms in areas that stay wet, as it warms, the methane emissions increase.
So are you seeing a dramatic increase in recent decades in these releases from the permafrost of the CO2 and of the methane?
Well, what we've seen is that, and is well documented, is that the system that was a carbon sink over 10,000 years is now a carbon source to the atmosphere.
And what is the cause of that?
The cause is climate change. It's a combination of the warming that's occurred in the Arctic, and the Arctic is warming about twice as fast as the rest of the planet.
So let me ask you, when we hear these climate skeptics out there, most of whom, of course, are paid for by the oil industry, but a lot of them are out there in the media talking about climate change and saying that this is just natural cycles, that it really doesn't have anything to do with man, that, you know, this is just kind of a normal flux of things. What would your response to that be?
Well, my response would be that the climate modelers, climate scientists, are well aware of the natural forcings on climate as well as the human-caused forcings. And all of the climate models that are used and all of the climate analyses include the natural processes. And when they model climate over the last 1,000 years or so, what they find is that if they build models with only the natural forcings, and these are things like volcanic activity,
right,
dust in the atmosphere, clouds, all the things that are pointed out as being important in controlling climate, mm-hmm. if they only use those, they can quite accurately model the past climate up until the Industrial Revolution. And then as there is more and more CO2 emitted in the atmosphere.
By burning from all the factories and things, burning
exactly.
fossil fuels.
And that comes from
cars.
Heating, electricity, transportation, everything that uses coal or natural gas or diesel or gasoline.
Okay. So when they included that in the modeling, what did they find?
Well, they found that, that then the models performed not only in the past, but in the current period. So basically, you cannot explain the warming that we're seeing and have seen over the last 150 years or so, based only on physical drivers, natural drivers.
And you are one of the people who's actually been measuring this. When you look at the permafrost and the rapidness, the increase in how fast it is melting or at least emitting this carbon into the atmosphere, you're seeing an acceleration. This is not the same rate that we would have seen, 300 years ago or 3,000 years ago.
Yeah. No, as I said, 300 years ago or 3,000 years ago, the Arctic was a carbon sink. It's now a carbon source. And, I've been working in.
So there's more coming out of it than there is going into it.
Exactly. And I've been working on the North Slope of Alaska, since, the early 70s. Mm-hmm. And I don't need scientific instruments to see the change that's occurred in that time. The sea ice retreat is evident. The change in the, when I started working there, it was virtually impossible to work without heavy down clothing and in perpetual fog.
Mm-hmm.
Now people are getting off the plane in shorts and T-shirts.
That's shocking.
And having 4th of July picnics on the beach and the kids waiting in the Arctic Ocean.
That's amazing.
So they're, we have the data. The data are mm-hmm. there, but really,
open your
you
eyes
don't
is
need
obvious.
It.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So for the record, have you been paid on your scientific research to come up with any particular finding one way or the other on this?
I think it's more the opposite.
Okay.
It's a struggle to maintain funding to conduct the research. There are much more lucrative research areas that I could be in. This is not something you do to make money. That's for sure.
You mentioned to me you've had some very intriguing interactions with some of the so-called skeptics out there, climate change denier experts, and that you actually were involved in a panel, a debate, so to speak, about climate change with some of them. Tell me about that.
I've been involved in several debates, including on the Hill, Capitol Hill in Washington. And in one, I remember after this very intense debate and with my opponent pointing out all the flaws that can be imagined in the models and all the alternative interpretations.
Alternative facts.
Yeah, alternative facts. At the end of this debate, and there was a reception cocktail hour afterwards, he came up to me and he said, you're right, I agree with you completely.
Wow.
And I said, why did you say what you said? He said, well, that's my job. That's what I'm paid to do.
So he's paid to lie.
Yeah.
Paid to lie.
Yeah.
And this is the oil industry, which is
it's
enormous.
Oil, it's natural gas, it's
coal.
Western Fuels, which is coal, has been a very big funder of contrarian information and think tanks.
And now we have the former head of ExxonMobil, which for many years was funding a lot of this climate science denial. Now he's the Secretary of State, and we have an appointee to the Environmental Protection Agency who was once suing the EPA and claims, or still is, I think, and claims to be a climate change skeptic. We're seeing the Trump administration taking down a lot of the climate change data off of the EPA website. Scientists worldwide scrambling to save the NASA satellite data. What do you think about all that?
It's very concerning, obviously. It's been a few years since we've had a president who didn't accept the facts in the associated with climate change and the attribution or the importance of human activity in causing the recent warming that we've seen.
How serious is this? I mean, if we go through 4 years or 8 years of a President Trump and nothing is done about climate change, or we start to roll back some of the things that have already happened, like the climate change accord in Paris, what does that mean for our planet?
Well, it's terrible. IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, which is pretty much the acknowledged authority on definitive statements about climate data, climate change, and has involved several thousands of scientists in the writing of the documents and analyses, came up with about 8 different scenarios of increase in CO2 in the 80s. From everything from our immediately recognizing the problem and reducing carbon emissions to our fiddle and let Rome burn attitude of business as usual, yeah. Continue to use what you want. In that 35 years since they came up with that, with those projections, we've exceeded the worst case scenario.
Wow.
So basically, our emissions are more than if we'd done nothing, if we'd done business as usual. So we've made no progress, really.
So all the wind and all the solar, it just hasn't been enough. Is that because we're seeing places like China?
A lot has to do with exporting, American consumerism around the world and countries wanting to emulate the U.S. level of consumption mm-hmm. around the world mm-hmm. and the fact that we're adding 1 billion people to the planet every 13 years.
Very.
So we have 1 billion more people every 13 years, and on average, each person emitting more CO2 than the previous year.
It seems to me that this whole climate change denial argument and this willingness of people to just believe this stuff from people who have no expertise at all or who are in the pay of the oil companies, one or the other, which seems to be the case in 100% of these so-called experts that I've checked out, and I'm sure you've probably found the same. It seems to me it's an awful lot like what we used to see with the tobacco industry in the early days when the scientists were coming out and saying, look, there's all this medical evidence that cigarettes cause cancer and other things. And, you know, we were seeing statistics, the actual increases, the more people smoke cigarettes, the more you were seeing lung cancer and all of these other things. And yet you had these paid shills for the tobacco industry going up and testifying on Capitol Hill that tobacco didn't cause cancer. And, you know, there was a certain number of people that would just believe it. I never understood that either. I mean, does that seem like a similar scenario?
It's similar, but with that model in mind, and others, I assumed it would take about 30 years from the time that climate change was recognized as a real threat to our way of life, civilization, to the planet, to the ecosystems of the planet. Mm-hmm. I figured it would take about 30 years from the time we recognized it, as it did with smoking and acid rain and air pollution and CFCs, for policy, effective policy to be invoked. And it's taking much longer than that. We really knew everything, scientifically, we knew everything we needed to know in the early 80s to implement appropriate policy to limit climate warming and increasing atmospheric CO2. And so we're now, 36 years later, and we are not much further along in that policy. Our best shot was the Paris Agreement that now we're threatening to pull out of.
Yeah, very frightening. It seems also that we're seeing more and more alternative facts getting out there through all of these internet channels and blogs and places that are really putting forward things that really aren't true. You gave an example when we were warming up before we went on the air about the ice cube argument. Can you repeat that for our listeners?
Yeah. One of the points that conservative radio and television likes to make is that one of the projections is increasing sea level rise.
Right.
And one of the causes of increasing sea level rise is the melting of glaciers.
Massive amounts of ice.
Massive amounts of ice, huge amounts of ice, including in Greenland, in Antarctica. Mm-hmm. And that this melting of the ice will actually increase the volume of the world's oceans and increase the sea level.
Right. Places like Coronado could just be underwater
right.
if this happens. Florida.
And what I've heard done on conservative radio and television is to start a false argument and say that scientists say that melting of icebergs is going to cause sea level rise, which...
And the analogy they use that supposedly would show that wouldn't happen is...
Well, the analogy is an ice cube floating in a glass of water. And they say, well, when that, you know, if the glass of water is full and the ice cube melts, does the water overflow? No, it doesn't. Therefore, the melting of the ice isn't going to increase the sea level.
And why is that wrong?
Well, it's wrong because if you suspended the ice over the glass and let it melt, then of course the volume of the water would increase.
Right. And the ice is on the land. And listeners, this is just common sense. If you don't believe that melting ice on land can put out an awful lot of water, just look at what's going on with the Oroville Dam up there with the massive snow melts. And, you know, we're looking at 200,000 people just had to be evacuated up there because they were worried that the tallest dam in the United States had a spillway overflow that was about to fail. So the consequences obviously can be huge. I guess it comes down to being smart consumers of information. Don't believe everything you hear. If you hear something that just sounds too odd to be true, do your research. If you're listening to conservative radio or liberal radio, go try to do some research. Find the facts yourself. What advice would you give to listeners if they want to find accurate sources, unbiased sources on something as important as climate change? How do you filter out whether something is true or might be a, you know, just a false statement?
Well, I think I would say go where the bulk of the experts are, the professionals, the practicing climate scientists, and what they're saying. The IPCC that I mentioned before has an executive summary. It's actually quite approachable.
And that stands for?
International Panel on Climate Change. It's an international group of over 1,000 scientists that periodically come out with updates evaluating both what is been happening with the climate and what's expected to happen in the future. And the summary to that is very easy to approach. But look at the credentials. Also look at how people are supported. If they're supported, you know, ultimately maybe one or two or three steps back by corporate interests, especially corporate interests associated with the fossil fuel industry.
Take that with a large grain of salt.
You might think that the information might be a bit skewed.
I want to wrap up by talking about the impacts of climate change locally, right here in San Diego County and specifically in East County. Now, you have done some research on what impact it can have on chaparral and forest environments, specifically the ones that we have right here.
Yeah.
What would you like to tell our listeners about that?
Well, we're going to see effects. Most simply, most of the climate projections are increasing temperature and increasing drought. And even if there's more rainfall, we can still have more drought if there's more evaporation.
Yeah, you can have a wet year or two, but...
You can have a wet year or two, and you can even have more rainfall. If it comes in the summer when it's not effective, or if it evaporates because it's hot, it won't be effective. But the models are pretty consistent in drought.
What's the impact going to be on our forests?
Well, I think we're already seeing it. You know, much of the Lagunas Cuyamacas that have burned are not coming back. And
yeah, I've had the Park Service people up there tell me that after 98% of the pines in Rancho Cuyamaca State Park burned, that they're fearful it will never come back as a pine forest, even though they're trying to replant, because the climate has just changed so much that it's not cold enough anymore for the pine trees
to thrive. It's a temperature and moisture effect. So the seedlings are not being successful. And even if they were successful, the drought causes them to be more susceptible to various diseases and insect pests. So,
yeah, we've seen tens of thousands of oak trees lost in just the last couple of years here because of bark-borne beetles that are just killing vast tracts of these oak trees that once covered so much of East County.
Yeah. I think a lot of our reserve areas are going to prove that are set aside where there are especially rich biodiversity. I expect to see the climate move out from under those so they're no longer functional. And I think we're going to see quite a bit more frequent chaparral fires or more intense worse wildfires. Yeah.
Not something that we need here in East County that's already had the worst wildfires repeatedly in California state history. Mm-hmm. Are there things that the average listener out there can do if you're concerned about climate change? And maybe we can't control what the president does, but what are some of the actions that you recommend that individuals who are concerned about climate change can do?
I really believe in leading by example and also creating local models. The city of Chula Vista went through an extensive planning process to be able to build new houses and still meet the Kyoto Protocol CO2 emissions, which was to the emissions level of 1990, and we're very successful in that effort.
So maybe citizens could ask their local cities, for example, or their county, to take similar kinds of actions.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it can be done at the most of local levels. The other thing that individuals could do is put solar hot water on their house. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely crazy that almost every house doesn't have thermal hot water.
I had
house. It's low tech, it's inexpensive, and it's a big source of CO2 emissions on a house-by-house basis.
I had that on my old house, and I'll tell this story. One day I had an SDG&E guy come out, and he said, "We're here to replace your meter." And I said, "Well, why?" "Well, we're showing you've had zero gas usage for several months." And I walked outside, and I said, "What do you see on my roof?" "Well, a solar panel." I said, "I have solar hot water heater. Of course I've had zero usage."
Yeah. Israel can handle the technology. Many countries use solar thermal. Why aren't we doing it? The next step, of course, is solar voltaic, electric. And I think as people do that, they see the benefits, other people see the benefits, we can start turning the curb, getting around the corner on the issue.
Should people be voicing concerns also to their members of Congress?
Absolutely.
What's happening at the national level?
Absolutely, yeah.
Dr. O'Shea, let me ask you this. We hear a lot of gloom and doom about climate science from some people. Do you believe that we could be reaching a point of being beyond a point of no return? Or is there still time to turn this around if governments get serious about this and take action?
I could answer that two ways. Based on our history and performance and policy over the last 40 years, I would say there's no hope and we're doomed. The other way I could answer that is if we had the right policy in place, if we demanded the right policy, I believe that with the technology that we already have, we could turn this around in a few years.
Well, that's encouraging. So there is still hope then.
There's still hope, but we have to act. We have to act decisively, and we're not doing it. So my pessimism comes from our lack of having done anything up to this point, but my optimism is that we have the technology and we could reduce CO2 emissions. And as soon as we do, that coupled with regrowth of natural lands and forests will remove CO2 from the atmosphere, and we actually could go back to previous levels of both CO2 and temperature.
Very good. Well, we're certainly going to be hopeful that the latter option is what will eventually happen and not the first. We are out of time, but I really want to thank you so much for coming in today. And listeners, I've been speaking with Professor Walter O'Shea. Dr. O'Shea is an internationally respected climate change scientist affiliated with San Diego State University and the University of California, Davis. And we want to thank you today for joining us on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
No, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.